Back again on another edition of the Capital Spotlight podcast. Your host, as always, the Director of Business Development at Lone Star Capital here, Craig McGrother, alongside the one, the only, two-time author, Mr. Suit Supply and Patek Philippe himself. Feeling better now, ruffled up, beaten up, battered, health concerns, so on and so forth. He's back. Well, I guess you'll hear it from him right now just in a second, but feeling better, hopefully, Mr. Beardsley.
Been a long, dusty road. I've had the flu for a week, and it's been a real nasty one. So glad to be back in the office. Yeah,
two-time flu,
two-time author, two-time flu. Got sick in San Antonio, and then really started feeling pretty bad before NMHC. Decided to take the flight to San Diego anyway, and then by the time I got to San Diego, I was a mess and had to abort my NMHC trip. So I'm very jealous that you and Brad got to enjoy and experience NMHC this year. But unfortunately I was not there. So we're gonna have to hear it from you as far as the NMHC recap.
Absolutely. Well, let's just lead right into that to start. NMHC was a lot better logistically and enjoyment wise than what we had experienced in Las Vegas last year. The attitude and mood for everyone we met with personally on this side was really positive with regards to the equity conversations. That's just my experience, but it was very similar to the IMN Laguna Beach, very similar conversations. Doing these both in a row, you're going to hit so much volume and ground. For me, it was cool because I did not enjoy it last year in Las Vegas. This year, I was really thrilled by it. We met with about 25 institutional JV-esque equity groups, of which very valuable people and relationships, that it's cool that those torches and stuff to a certain extent are getting passed to me with regards to my responsibilities. So the goal is to have you do nothing, or I should say very little, and delegate in-person responsibilities, traveling, meetings more to myself, have you comfortable, figure out ways to double the company revenue while I'm out there boots on the ground, sorting out relationships with new ones as well as existing. So it was fun to be spearheading, running those conversations and coordinating everything. I want to make it a bigger point of emphasis to truly take notes as to what everyone wants. So I have a better Rolodex and I'm not just blindly, you know, distributing deals out into the wind, so to speak. And, you know, we've really talked about this, limiting down to people who we think are better fits than not. I'm very happy to say that I feel as if with the groups I met with, we were texting about this throughout the week. But it felt very clear that there's just not an alignment with some groups we've been sending deals to for a while. So we'll probably still send deals, but we're not really going to focus as deep as much as we would with some other groups, of course. So it was really nice to spearhead that, figure out and put a face to name for all these people we're sending emails to, because I haven't met some of these people, but you've known them for a while. So it is always fun to put face to the name, to meet in person, to establish another wrinkle and layer to the relationship in person. So it feels really good to have done that these last 2 weeks at NMHC and I'm in Laguna. I'm just so excited. I think we're really on the cusp of attracting really whatever medium of equity we want. If we want to keep syndicating, which gives us the functionality and flexibility to 1031 exchange deal to deal to deal, if we can keep raising, you know, $80 to $150 million of deal of equity a year through that route, very valuable. But of course, easy to scale and to buy a lot more deals if we just do JVs where it's just, you know, said institutional equity group paired with Lone Star personal private network and stuff, our retail equity, our personal network, friends and family, money like that, and those who inbound from the incredible lead magnets that we've created and the network that we've cultivated, you know, having just two things to worry about with regards to one group there and then our equity as well might make it easier. So there's so many ways to skin the cat in this business, which is great. I would love to have the optionality of both and be able to kind of pick and choose who we want to work with and not work with. I'll throw it back to you.
Yeah, that's the aim that we've had for years now. And it just takes a long time to build up these relationships and the firm's expertise in order to be able to attract really sophisticated investors across the spectrum. And so I think we're finding that the work that we've been putting in over the last handful of years is now finally starting to show. And it's right place, right time, because here we are in 2024, looking at some really attractive opportunities that will pay off over the next 3 to 5 years, as this year is presenting as a great buying opportunity.
Without a doubt. And I definitely think if you can raise money through the syndication route, you may get better terms and a little bit of flexibility with regards to the legacy of the equity tranches of going 1031 to 1031 to 1031, of course, and just letting that money compound and grow in a tax lien deferred efficient manner. So there's that opportunity and optionality there, of course. But it is just really nice to have, I said, both angles to it. And I think that a lot of the reasons why some groups have probably said no to us before or were really close, because if I had a dollar for every single time someone said, "Oh, we were so close, we were so close, like we really like your deals," I hope that they truly mean that and it's not just, keeping us positive and, stroking our ego a bit. But I have to imagine it's probably a little bit of both, which is fine. But I definitely think the bottlenecks before as to why they may have not said yes is hadn't been through a market cycle. That's probably number one. Number two was maybe we weren't vertically integrated at the time when they were looking at a deal. That's obviously really important for us then. And then also, I think one thing is your age. Now that you're more mature, older, and wiser, not that you look dramatically older, I just think attracting equity from that perspective to get everyone to sign off on it, it just will be a little bit easier now. So those are probably some of the bottlenecks, and also full cycle on deals and just portfolio size. All those boxes are checked now. So I think our ease of attracting, the higher quality, our bigger equity checks like this is definitely going to be more feasible and easier to do. And it's just a matter of us finding the right deals and me taking diligent notes as well as yourself to mix and match and pair everyone accordingly and correctly.
Well, I'd like to go back to what you said earlier, because all this talk about us being the right fit for people is really a big focus when you're starting out. But then now we're getting to the point where a lot more of our conversations are centered around whether they are the right fit for us. And that's really important, because when you're scrambling to raise capital and you're just looking to grow your business at all costs, you lose sight of that, and you lose sight of the importance of actually picking who you're working with. Because when it comes down to it, and it comes down to your business, and it comes down to making money, it's a day-to-day experience. And you want to work with people that you want to work with. That's just a universal truth for everyone. And so for us, it's no different. And I'm really loving how we're spending time actually talking about how enjoyable it is to work with somebody, or how enjoyable it isn't, and whether they perhaps cause us grief down the road, or they might cause additional work or complications. And so those are things to be
During the raise
cognizant of,
process, yeah.
right? Because the raise process is stressful enough. We don't want to have added strain to it. And so that's another calculus, not just, okay, well, can they raise money for us, or are they a good investor for us? Yes or no. It's what terms and what headache come along with this investment. And I think as we grow with time, we'll learn more who our true partners are that we really enjoy calling up and having a conversation with. And also, really importantly, when times get tough and something goes wrong, you see who your good partners are and who step up and really shoulder the burden, or productively troubleshoot with you rather than work against you.
With that said as well, I echo all those comments as we're going through a couple of raises right now. On top of that, I will also say it was a slight paradigm switch as well. And this is once you get going as a sponsor and you kind of cross that barrier of can't raise to I can raise to now I can be choosy and selective with who I raise with. It was kind of interesting. I heard, if you really listen closely and you really are truly present in the conversation, or you're truly looking to analyze words and stuff, they'll actually kind of you'll learn and listen that once you have good deals and you have a good reputation, they're looking to get into your deal more so than you're looking to have them get into your deal, because you have choices. And these groups know who's good, they'll know who is not so good, but there's likely, if one group says yes to you, they're probably not the only group that's going to say yes to you once you've kind of hit that hurdle. So then it's okay, well, whose term sheets do we like more? Who do we align with more? Who would be better for our brands to work with? Who do we think has a longer tarmac to work with for us? So I'm definitely going to think that not only will we have just a group say yes to us on our deals coming up, we'll actually probably have multiple. and it'll be up to our discretion to figure out the route that we want to go and what feels true and whole to us as a firm. And that's one of the biggest takeaways. That's one of the bigger paradigm shifts that I have, is we don't have to be too desperate for equity, especially considering how we can raise from all these different channels. You know, I think when people are asking, naturally we ask what they look for, what they say yes to. That's one of my favorite questions I ask the groups is, hey, you know, what are the deals that you said yes to, so I can find something that you would say yes to? And last year and moving forward, because these aren't constants, what are you looking for? What is attractive for you in the new year, in this fund, with where you're at in the fund? Is this a new fund? Is this the back end of the fund? Is your fund too Texas focused, where you have a mandate to diversify? Or is this a new fund where, hey, there's no issue with legacy investments, and maybe they have no deals in Houston, or, you know, their other fund had too many for their liking, for the board who's running that, for their investor community, where they need to diversify. So it's important to figure that out. But then it's just as important to figure out who we want to say yes to, the alignment, and, you know, as I said before, who do we want to work with? So it's really exciting to be at the tipping point where we have optionality and flexibility. And maybe there's some deals you just want to syndicate, or maybe there's better quality real estate deals where the average boutique person or the mom and pop investor, maybe less sophisticated, isn't going to like seeing a deal level of 15 or 14 IRR, but the big 50 million, you know, $30 to $50 million check riders will look like a deal like that and be salivating because they see the value at hand there. And that's kind of what their buckets of capital are for.
Yep, very true.
Aspire, moving on and segueing to the next topic here. I just want to let everyone know we put into our underwriting 6%. And I believe for our debt, which is a 5-year fixed rate based off the 5-year treasury, as well as a lender spread, our incredible friend who we'll hopefully have on the show that I was fortunate enough to meet with, Nate Lowy, got us incredibly hot debt. We rate locked at an incredible day. I think it was down 14 points the day that we locked, and we ended up rate locking and getting a interest rate of 5.72, which is beating our projected underwriting model by 28 basis points, 28 bips, not 28 points, but basis points, as you will obviously correct me, as you should, which is really big. And I want to talk about a couple of things. How awesome it is to have debt actually move in our direction for the first time seemingly in over a year. So huge. Obviously, it goes up, it goes down, but we didn't be able to take advantage of the volatility of the rate locking going down. We fortunately did that. We're so excited for that. Of course, what does that do? It obviously only enhances our equity multiple. It enhances our IRR and, of course, our cash flow. The easiest thing to solve for in these, because those are, you know, not as easy to predict, but having a lower interest rate there while, you know, raising the same amount of equity will only just boost up our cash on cash return for our investors. So that's not a insignificant amount of delta that we created between projected versus actuals. So it is so nice to be in the money there, as they say, in the green there, as opposed to the red, and having to explain to our investors that this deal is not as sweet as we were forecasting it to be.
It's always great to underpromise and overdeliver. So that's important to bake in a buffer on your interest rate. But like you said, it was a really great couple of days where treasuries ticked down pretty aggressively. I think about a total of 25 basis points or so. And if you check rates today, they've popped up more today. And it just continues to be a great look that to lock when we locked, which speaks to the importance of one's ability to rate lock early and be ready to go. With that being said, a lot of our investors will ask us, oh, are you rate locked? When are you rate locking? And those questions can come in a month before closing. And oftentimes a month before closing, it's not feasible to rate lock. Fortunately, in this case, we're now less than a couple weeks out. And so we were able to rate lock with ease. And we were even able to get the early rate lock fee waived, which I think is a pesky hidden fee of sorts, because a lender will quote you a lender spread at application. But then, of course, you're going to rate lock early if you can, but then you don't want to get charged a 6 or 9 basis point hidden fee for doing so. It kind of eats, like, let's say rates jump down 6 bips and you go, oh, today would be a great day to lock, but then you lock and then pay a 6 basis point early rate lock fee. Well, it just ate away at the value. So it was really nice to have that fee waived. That feels good. Obviously, we're talking about 6 basis points. That's 0.06%. So it's not, to many people hearing that, they would think, oh, well, that's inconsequential. That's de minimis. But it's really not. BIPs really do count. But even still, it's just nice to have a good partner, lending partner, who's not hitting you with hidden fees every step of the way. So I appreciated that. That was a very good rate lock experience that we had last week.
Yeah, and we definitely have a preferred in-house lender, Juniper Capital Group, with Nate Lowy. He's incredible. He is the person we want to work with. And the value of that is multifaceted. Number one, when we were at NMHC together, I met with him as well as some brokers we hadn't met with. Brad was busy running around doing his thing with the other brokers, but I stepped in as at a slight gap, 30-minute gap. So I went over with Nate, and he was just speaking so highly of us. And he was in the trenches trying to find deals for us to do together because he knows what we can do and we know what he can do. And we want to funnel our business in that way. And then sometimes you're going to get handcuffed by a deal potentially from here and there to use them for debt. And we'll probably do a collaboration situation. Net will kind of serve as an advisor if we need to. But we really do love working with Nate. He gets us the best rate, the best lender spread, and really saves us a bunch of money, bringing us opportunities. He just is our go-to person. So if you're a debt person, I respect your business, but you're probably not going to get our business. So don't reach out nor ask for that. Not looking for it. We have the best person in-house there who truly is super, 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 super valuable. So can't thank Nate enough for his service, for his guidance on this one. And also the value of having him to kind of co-broker the debt on a deal with another broker is he'll keep the other group honest, where, you know, there's all these, as you alluded to before, hidden fees, little things that come up through the escrow process that are less than ideal for sure. So the fact that he's there to help navigate that process, to make it smooth, make it streamlined, is so valuable. So to Nate, we thank you to get the incredible debt spread to all of your investors, all of our investors and partners in the deal. We're so excited together to get that mutually done. And you just don't know where that's going to be helpful. That's not to say the deal is not going to be that much better on the front end, or that you're going to get all receipt of that cash flow. Maybe, you know, we take over the property and there's some sort of, you know, red flag or something we didn't come up or find out. That can happen during the takeover process. You know, it's not necessarily the easiest solution to take over a property from another group, but that will only serve as a nice buffer and cushion to the cash on cash return and overall the health of the deal. So we're just so happy about that. And if you're wondering, Aspire is fully funded at this point with regards to the equity and whatnot, but we do have several other deals we're working on right now that we can't technically share due to the nature of them. But if you would like to learn more about that opportunity or any other opportunity with Lone Star Capital, whether you're looking to partner with us and raise some equity on our deals, and or if you're an LP investor just looking to passively invest, reach out to myself. My email is craig@lscre.com. Once more, craig@lscre.com. There is the shameless plug of the day. So with that said, Nate, thank you so much for your work and just a little housekeeping with regards to Aspire. Incredible rate lock, 28 points beat. So that's awesome. On to the next subject, a real deal article came out regarding Texas indicator Elevate with a Arbor foreclosure or pre-foreclosure. Rob, if you want to pull that up, share the screen to kind of go through it. Of course, anytime information like this comes out, we want to comment on it, as Houston is our flagship market. We've got about $400 million of assets specifically in that hub, in that market. And we've definitely learned places we want to buy, not buy. But I just want to have, Rob, your take, looking through this, analyzing it, putting your brain and fingertips on it, what you think with regards to that deal and, you know, how this could be avoided. Kind of state of this, and just maybe generally the state of Houston. Is Houston still a good market we want to buy in? Does this make you concerned, or is it just, hey, as simple as the title of your book, Bad Debt and Equity Structure? Obviously, that's not exactly your title, but of course, structuring debt and equity for multifamily real estate. Did they have the improper structuring of that? Did they have the improper debt profile? Will we see more of this? Let me know your thoughts.
So the first thing I notice in this article is Ivan Kaufman's watch here in the picture. It looks like he's wearing a 5712. Great, great choice. Very impeccable. Nice watch. Yeah, lovely. It looks really nice there. So good job on him. Although his company has had a lot of negative publicity, I'm sure he's continuing to enjoy that watch very much. as well as his private jet, as well as his private golf course in his backyard. So all good things there. As far as this article is concerned, and this deal in particular, it's actually a deal that we were looking at in the office late one night. And then, funny enough, this article came out the next day. So that was just kind of funny timing, how we were actually looking at this deal as a potential purchase for us. But back when we were looking at it the day before the article came out, the numbers didn't really add up. It didn't make sense to us because, unfortunately, this property is encumbered by a very high leverage floating rate bridge loan. So obviously, not to belabor the point, as we've gone over the dynamics of 2021-ish a lot of times, but basically, a lot of deals were financed with high leverage bridge loans that were unfortunately floating rate. And at the time, people were certain that rates would stay low, which of course they didn't. The Fed rose rates at the fastest pace in history. And that put a lot of owners, like this example here, which is this property called Selena in Houston, in a very difficult situation. Within 6 months of ownership, they were already unable to service their debt payments because debt payments rose so rapidly because of the Fed's actions. Right? Yeah. And so also at the same time, a lot of these properties were bought with very rosy projections because the market was so competitive. In order to win the bid, to be the highest bidder for a deal, you had to really assume everything to go perfectly in your numbers for the numbers to make sense. So you'd have to assume you're going to be able to do renovations, raise rents, everything would stay perfect. And the problem with that is it's very aggressive. And we haven't even really seen operations soften that significantly yet. I think that is still yet to come, which is a scary thought. But what happened is, because of how competitive the market was, it pushed this fervor, this aggressive bidding across the board. And so here's an example of a property in Houston, which frankly is located kind of in the North Shore area. It's not a very good location. And that doesn't mean you can't make money in a location like this. It's just that this is not the place to get really aggressive because this is not bulletproof location. This is not high quality real estate. And
probably bad with regards to, if it's North Shore, probably the Northeast pocket would be my guess then, if I'm not mistaken. Insurance issues, probably tough, being on the water there, could be in a flood zone. So that's just, you know, we've gone through trials and tribulations as well with regards to where we've acquired and don't want to acquire moving forward, and are that much more niched down to the pockets and deal size, so we can kind of red light, green light deals. So with that said, I have a couple kind of follow-up thoughts here, which is, clearly, as you mentioned, probably not the pocket you'd want to buy in unless it's how could you not basis. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And we're looking at the deal today, and you know, we're not, based on our numbers, we would not be interested in owning the property at the loan amount. So the way that we see these sorts of deals playing out is Arbor, the lender here, is going to have to foreclose most likely. And then from there, they would put the property up for sale. And presumably, if our valuation is correct, Arbor would actually sell the property for a loss, for less than their loan amount. And that would reset the basis. That would clear the deck and allow a new owner to come in at a lower basis and hopefully make money on this deal later. So unfortunately, we have this ugly nose on our screen because of this ad. Sorry about that.
If you'd like.
So, yeah. So that's the unfortunate thing that's kind of holding up a lot of these deals, is a lot of deals in the market right now, or that aren't on the market right now, are unable to transact because the value is roughly somewhere plus or minus the loan amount. And if you're right around that value, it really comes down to the lender whether the property can change hands. Because if a buyer is not willing to pay more than the loan amount, then the equity owner is not really in a position to sell the project at less than the loan amount. And that creates a logjam here. And so we have a lot of deals that we've been looking at that are roughly in this situation. And I think that once the market works through this issue and either decides, sorry, either decides that the lenders decide that they're willing to actually take a loss and let these deals go for less than loan amount, then that will really create a flood of transactions because a lot of people will step in. There's a lot of money on the sidelines that wants to buy deals. And the interesting thing is, the question is, will some of this money on the sidelines eventually feel the pressure of pent-up demand, wanting to put this money out and wanting to allocate capital? And will it pressure itself into buying properties at a higher value than they'd like to? So, for example, if the property's loan amount here is 38 million, we frankly think the deal is worth 27 million. That's a huge loss that the lender would have to take. Well, is there a buyer out there that has aggressive enough capital behind them that they would simply just buy the loan amount or buy the property at the loan amount at 38 million just to get their hands on the deal, just so that they can put out equity? Yes, they might be quote unquote overpaying for the deal, but at least it gets them off the sidelines. And so that's kind of what we're waiting to see. Who flinches first? Is it the lenders and they start taking losses, or is it the equity and they start jumping in at higher bases?
Yeah, my question for you as well is, do you know when this deal was also purchased? Was this probably 2022, first half of it, or second half of 2021?
I'm sure it was somewhere around that time.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned before, I mean, what is the workout? How long does it take, for these foreclosures to occur? Because it's not an overnight process. Obviously, they're trying to shop it around. What is the makeup of that process if you're knowledgeable regarding it? Because people are talking about and asking, oh, well, can you buy these bank assets? Or a lot of retail investors, think foreclosure like GFC. Now, homes aren't going to be foreclosing, but I can sure as heck tell you that these rentals, or sorry, these multifamily deals or office deals will be. So, can you maybe shed some light as to what the foreclosure process looks like, the length associated, and then, this is how rescue capital comes into play, or a rescue buyer, or bank workouts, just things of that nature, if you want mind just touching on it with the knowledge you have.
In Texas, the process is pretty quick. So there's ways for sure to drag it out and to negotiate. And I would say that the delays that people are seeing is more so a function. It's not a function of the foreclosure process, and it's more of a function of the fact that the lender and the borrower both want to play extend and pretend, and they want to kick the can down the road. So lenders have a incentive to not foreclose. So you're seeing lenders move towards foreclosure only in the most desperate of circumstances, or where the asset itself is very attractive and the lender's basis is very good. The problem that we have here is the market is so upside down, where lenders have such high valuations of loans on these properties that the lender themselves doesn't want to take back the real estate, because for them, the prospect of owning the real estate at their loan amount is unattractive
And
in today's
operating.
market. Yeah, and
Yeah.
lenders aren't set up to operate. And so, all in, it makes for an unattractive proposition. They'd rather just keep the borrower in place to manage the asset, even if the borrower's equity is non-existent, right? You're basically, the way I look at it, is the lender is getting an asset manager to manage their property for free, right? The borrower is working for free at this point for what is essentially a hope and a prayer that one day the property will be worth more than the loan amount and it will generate positive equity for the ownership. So, speaking of the word hope, I'd like to at some point get to the topic of hope notes as well.
No, let's get into that right now. I was going to segue there brilliantly, but you beat me to the punch. So with that said, why don't you tee it up and explain what this new investment vehicle option is like? Or I don't know if you'd even consider that, but maybe a workout, whatever it may be. Fascinating stuff here with this hope note. So please take it away.
Yeah, so a lot of people, maybe not a lot, but some people out there are looking at this upside down situation, and they are looking at a deal that they own and they're realizing that they're unable to keep the deal alive and that the property is, essentially worth plus or minus the loan amount. Let's say more so likely minus, right? So they realize that their situation is all messed up and they need to sell. But they also recognize, like we just discussed, that there's this big demand from equity on the sidelines looking to allocate capital. So this is an interesting product of what is somewhat of a more aggressive market. And so we'll see if it actually pans out. I haven't actually heard of anybody pulling this off, but we're seeing sellers who are in these bad situations propose what they call a hope note. So basically what they do is they recognize that the property is worth less than the loan amount, but they ask a buyer anyhow to purchase the property for them for the loan amount and closing costs. So that way the seller gets out and the lender gets out. And so that kind of resets the deck. So that way the existing owner no longer has any issues with the lender as far as foreclosure or any sorts of problems there. And then because the new owner is coming in at such a low basis and the seller is allowing the new owner to come in for that basis because they're quote unquote letting them buy the deal for the loan amount. But that really begs the question, do they have another option? But that's just this game of chicken that we are going to see unfold. So basically, the seller then structures a deal with the new owner that, okay, you got to get in at the loan amount. You got to get in at a good price. So what's going to happen is I want a share of the upside after you hit a 18% IRR or 25% IRR. And so I'll use specific numbers. So we have been offered this scenario to purchase a property for the loan amount from a seller. And then we would essentially get an 18% preferred return. So we get all the profit from the deal up to an 18% IRR. And then they want to take 30% of the profit above an 18% IRR on the back end. And so this is 3, 5, 7 years down the road of our ownership. So that's why it's called a hope note, because the existing equity is worthless today. But what they're hoping is that the new buyer does well with the investment and they're able to participate in that upside. But I think a 30% take above an 18% IRR is really, really aggressive. And I don't think people are going to be signing up for that, because remember, that's an 18% project level return. And so I think you're going to need to see perhaps a 25% IRR achieved by the new ownership. And above that, you know, you can share a little bit of the upside, 10% or 20% or something like that. I think my stance on these hope notes is I would just imagine that a lot of these deals are just going to be foreclosed on anyway. So why not just wait and buy it from the bank later?
I just don't see, and we've alluded to this and we've spoken on this subject so many times. Don't chase, you know, a bad deal with this setup. Get something new, restart it, refresh it. That is where my time and energy and focus is going to be, not on taking care of someone else's problem and burden. And yeah, it's just not something I would ever be interested in here, unless it's so compelling. It's a how could you not? But it just doesn't make sense for a group like us to focus on a hope note structure where we could have 100% or at least have, you know, no kind of kicker or pref coupon in our equity there. It just doesn't make sense for us. It's not kind of in alignment with what we're seeking. But it's certainly potentially an option for those who are struggling. And there is a lot of struggle coming. We just broke down that article, of course, but there is a lot of issues that are occurring, and this won't be the only creative way to theoretically save a foreclosure. And I can fully understand why the seller or the operator want to do that, because no one wants to get on, you know, these foreclosure lists where you may not be able to borrow and raise money again in the future. It's just not good. It's one thing to get capital called. It is a whole set of warm and issues to get foreclosed on, as I'm sure anyone listening to this can appreciate it. Capital call, one thing, you're losing money or money is getting diluted. For everything to just completely evaporate is a harder pill to swallow and circumstance to work through for your future longevity. So all interesting there with regards to hope notes. Additionally, I saw another comment you want to go through, which is supplemental stacks. So can you speak as to what you'd like to cover on that subject as well?
Oh no, that was us talking about supplements. health supplements.
Okay, gotcha. I didn't know the supplemental loans and whatnot, but that is Hope Notes there. On to the next topic, which is supplements that you're taking right now. Let's get into it. Let's break it down. You didn't probably bring your full cabinet here, but I don't think there's enough space in your briefcase for that. But why don't we speak on the supplements that you take on a daily basis, or I guess probably as our good friend Teddy would recommend, to never take any supplement every single day. But why don't you break into what you like to take on your daily uses and whatnot. Hopefully more vitamin C, considering your unfortunate health route to start the year.
Yeah, well, I feel like it's pretty ironic to talk about health supplements while I'm over here dying from the flu, but nevertheless, we will get into it. I do think it's hard for me to like honestly get excited about this topic right now, just given how bad I feel, but it is a topic that I am passionate about and excited to share more about. Actually, funny enough, our good friend Johnny Walker asked me to speak on his summit last, I think, a week and a half ago. And it was funny because he asked me to speak and he said, "What? I don't want you to talk about real estate. And I want you to talk about health and your life and the gym and your routine and how you live a good life." And I go, "Oh, wow, that's such an interesting topic. That's so different." And I actually had a really good time talking about a morning routine, nightly routine, health supplements, health routines, and things like that. So yes, that was great. So I'll kind of share some of the highlights there. So as far as supplements, I think it's really critical that everyone take vitamin D3 and a K2 or K1, K2 supplement combination, just because the majority of Americans are deficient in vitamin D. So that's just a no-brainer supplement. Also, not all of us stand out in the sun every day. And if we did, that necessarily wouldn't be the best for our skin. So I think taking vitamin D in supplement form is a great way to go. So I'll kick it off with that. And I do disagree with our friend Teddy. I do think that you should take supplements every day or as prescribed by your doctor. So yeah, I think that's perfectly fine.
Right. And I probably get more sun than I should, as people ask, "Oh, how are you so tan all the time?" Well, I do live in Arizona, where I should take vitamin D with the K, whatever you call it, K2, K3, kindergarten, this, that, whatever it may be. Obviously, it's helpful to avoid the sun. I need to wear sunscreen every day, but that is very useful. But being in Arizona as opposed to New York, naturally, there's a little more light that we get here juxtaposed to where you're at, for sure. What I like to take is magnesium. I like to take Alpha Brain from Onnit.com. I like to take New Mood, and I like to also have a sugar-free either liquid IV or electrolytes for your day. I think it's very helpful for hydration. You can drink water all day long, but it's just going to be cycling and shuffling through you. So truly absorbing that with electrolytes, with salt, with lemon, very, very crucial to make sure that you do stay hydrated. Obviously, being in Arizona this time of year, don't need it as much, but in the summer months, you going through a gallon of water a day just simply isn't enough, because you're gonna need it, especially if you're active and run around like me. I run 40 minutes every morning, so your body is just, you know, leaving with the dry heat here every single day, liquid. So it's crucial to ramp that up depending upon where you're located. But I like my Alpha Brain, my New Mood, magnesium, electrolytes. Am I missing anything else that I typically take? Oh, zinc also a couple times a week, if I'm not mixing in my oysters, of course, at the one, the only Buck and Rider, although seemingly I have residency there. I'm going to go there this week twice. So I will get my allotment there for sure. So those are the supplements that I like to use. What else did you not mention? You
so
like
what
my
magnesium?
Sure. Yeah.
So what magnesium are you taking?
The glycinate. I texted you the one. I'm not pretending that I'm the expert. And this is the importance of your network. This is the importance of surrounding yourself with other winners and people who have done trial and error, much like me getting my house may potentially sell here coming up. My good friend as well, Teddy, had one through the ringer with regards to sourcing the best contractors and people of that nature to get your house set up and workers around the house. Similarly, he's also done the research as well as you have as well regarding the supplements to take. So I just text you something, or text you guys saying, "Hey, what do I need to get?" And you will sort me out. I don't have to go through the brain trauma and the headache of figuring that out. I'm not trying to be the expert in everything. I just want to be very good at raising money for multifamily real estate. That's all I'm looking to be good at. And then I'll defer to the experts in the other categories for that is fit to supplement, no pun intended, into my life, their expertise. So I used whatever you recommend to get is what I have, but I believe it's glycate, which is helpful. And I'm pretty sure if you're having sleep problems as well, I was looking at some, I think it was like a YouTube short or somewhere on YouTube, but hey, if you're struggling with sleeping, take magnesium and that will help you with sleep. So
yeah, magnesium glycinate is important to take because there's a lot of magnesiums out there. There's magnesium oxide, there's magnesium citrate, and that can give you diarrhea. So you want to avoid cheap magnesium supplements, which will opt for lower forms of magnesium. So glycinate or biglycinate is really great. And then the other one that's also really good, they're different, is magnesium threonate. So threonate, I think, is a really fantastic supplement to take. It is actually, as I understand it, it provides the electricity. It helps with the conducting of your in your brain. So the
like
magnesium
the
helps with your body, but the magnesium threonate helps with brain. So it helps with memory and cognition, and so I find that to be very important. So
should I stack that as well as to what I'm taking currently?
Absolutely,
okay
yeah, yeah.
Why don't you send me the link to that, please, then? And I'll be perspicacious and move with speed here and acquire it on the spot.
Yeah, I'll send it over to you. So that's a big one I like. And speaking of brain stuff, I like taking mushroom complex. So there's a blend of mushrooms, and so that you've got reishi and chaga and lion's mane, and these are all really fantastic for your immunity, for your brain, your memory, all those things. I know you take the Onnit mushroom supplements with the new mood, which is a similar thing, I believe. So yeah, mushroom supplementation is really fantastic for your brains, similar to the magnesium threonate. Some other highlights for me would be cocoa flavanols. Cocoa flavanols is basically the active ingredient, or the most important ingredient, in dark chocolate. So rather than eating dark chocolate, you just take a scoop of this, and it's really good for your heart. And so, yeah, keeping your heart in shape is really important. I like that. NAC is a really no-brainer one. NAC is the precursor for glutathione. That's really good for your liver and your lungs. So I'm not sure why it's not helping me right now, but but I still take it every day.
You live
day.
In the belly of the beast with regards to sickness and, you know, anything that could come up. You likely have a very strong immune system that's being tampered with and tested to its full stabilities. You know, it's so funny, and I joke about this, but I truly and sincerely mean this. I could go probably a week without actually truly having to interact if I DoorDash stuff. You can't, and I could still walk around my neighborhood, do this, do that. You couldn't go more than 2 seconds because you'd greet and meet and see everyone in your you know, building and stuff that works there, of course. So you know, not possible there. There's just so much natural and extra rub that occurs, obviously, in New York City to boost up theoretically your immune system, as opposed to myself. Although I've shook hands with a zillion people, I fortunately avoided getting sick, which is nice. I don't know how, considering, but feel very grateful for my health, and let's hope that we can keep it going.
All right, so here's what I'll do. I actually just prepared my most up-to-date supplement list for Sam.
Ooh.
And I'm not sure if I included you in the email, but I will send that to you. And then if anybody listening wants that full supplement list that I take every single day, you could just pass it along as well. I just have all the link saved on Amazon, so you can quickly get it on Amazon.
And I apologize to those who are looking for the training manual for Lone Star. We are going to keep that in-house. So for those who reached out, apologies. I spoke too soon on that. But I will direct you to the underwriting coursing and such that Rob has done with regards to Older videos from 3 to 4 years ago, those still hold true and are similar. So go through the older videos there as opposed to the podcasts and supplement it with the podcasts to kind of hear thought process and logic. But for training, things of that nature, go to the old videos there. Also, reading Rob's both of his books are also good cornerstones to essentially learning the business more and helping you think the way Rob thinks. So.
Sounds great. All right. Well, I just sent that email over to you.
Cool. Awesome. Finally, the last topic of conversation. We're bringing it back. We haven't spoke too much about this recently, but we're going to talk about a very, very unique timepiece that you, in fact, are wearing right now currently, the Reverso. So why don't you talk about the significance? Because there is quite a bit actually associated with this watch. This watch is definitely exuding an old money look. It is not too in your face. It is not a gold new Audemars Piguet or a Rolex. It is a timeless Reverso. It's a JL, correct? Can you pronounce it? Because I always...
So people in the watch world call it JLC, standing for Jaeger LeCoultre, a French brand. But it's Swiss made, but it's a French, I believe it's a French guy. And
well, it makes sense because Switzerland, as you know, if you look at a map, borders four countries. Of course, on the left side, there'd be the more, if you're closer to Geneva, which where all the cool banking is done, that is French. Obviously, the southern area, that's Italy. And then if you go east, that is Austria and north Germany. So there's no way to truly access it during World War II and all those conflicts that happened in Europe. Switzerland was uniquely isolated where it could bomb itself to have no access points to get into the country. The only way you could attack it is if dropping troops in via airstrike and from above. So fun little history lesson there. That's the unique nature to Switzerland, geographically giving it some advantages from an entrance point. So sorry, little history right there, but that's the unique nature to Switzerland. It's also very much so a melting pot of all those cultures.
Yeah, so I didn't brush up on my JLC history, but it is, this Reverso in particular is a very important watch because this is
can
actually
keep it holding up so people give it a better, bigger feel of it as opposed to showing it and then pulling it away, please. Thank you.
So as contrary to what you think you're looking at, you might be thinking you're looking at a dress watch, but this is actually, funny enough, a sports watch, because when this came out in 1930s, this was considered sporty because the concept of a wristwatch was a foreign concept at the time. A dress watch was a pocket watch, and nobody really wore watches on their wrist yet at that time. And so, however, people actually, this watch originated and I think became popular because of British soldiers playing polo in India. They wanted to keep the time while playing polo. And so obviously polo is a sport. And so they put this watch on their wrist and it was a sports watch. And the reason why this watch is called the Reverso is because actually to protect the sapphire crystal on the front of the watch while playing polo, they would take the watch and reverse it around. And now the watch was protected while they played polo. And that's why it's called the Reverso. And that's why this is a sports watch. In modern times, the Reverso is more so of a relic of history, more so a gimmick. Also, the reverse side of the case is now a fantastic place for an engraving. So here you see I have my signature RB3 engraved on the back of the case.
Like you have on everything that you have from Tumi, all your Tumi products, which I will give you a shameless talk about here and add Tumi. Everything you have is Tumi. I think your backpack as well as your briefcase, which I can actually see the RB3 back there as well if you want to pull that up right now currently, just to make it homogenous. You have that everywhere. And you also have a very cool story, Rob, with regards to when you acquired this piece, where you acquired the piece. I believe I'm linked up with you on that trip. But do you want to talk about the historical significance as it pertains to this specific item?
Yes, I would love to. So it was a very fun process of acquiring this piece. This watch you could say is actually my first love. I remember first getting into watches at 15 years old, and I remember watching YouTube videos. And for whatever reason, the Reverso caught my eye. It was just a little bit different. The rectangular case, its beauty and elegance, it's just a little different. And so I was actually in Paris in summer of 2021, and I was just walking around, checking out the shops, and I went into the JLC store, and I walked in, and I wanted to try on a Reverso, and they had Reversos in stock, but they didn't have one the size I wanted or in the metal I wanted. I wanted a rose gold case like you see here, and I also wanted a vintage-sized watch, something that would look similar to what Don Draper wore in Mad Men. So you could see the way that it looks on my wrist. It's a very small size, very vintage.
Old and money so, look.
And so I walked out disappointed from that JLC boutique in Paris, but it got me thinking. And so I started just kind of Googling around online, looking for what could be a better match for me. And lo and behold, I found this exact watch in Munich, Germany, at a watch store. And I called them up and I said, "Hey, I'm in Paris right now. Can I buy the watch and you'll ship it back to my home address in America?" And they said, "Yes, we can do that, but the payment's going to be more complicated and shipping is complicated and there's tariffs." And I thought to myself, "You know what? Why don't I just fly over to Munich and pick it up?" And they said, "Okay, that sounds good." And so the very next morning, I got up, took a backpack to the airport. I didn't book a hotel. I didn't pack a suitcase or anything. And also the funny part is I didn't even wear a watch to the airport. So I went to the Paris airport, flew over to Munich, went into, it was my first time in Germany. Everything's great. Mercedes, taxis, jump into a taxi, go straight to the jeweler. The watch looks great. I pick it up and I put it right on my wrist. They say, "Well, do you want the box? Do you want..." No, I don't want anything, because I didn't want to deal with tariffs or anything like that. So I just wanted to put the watch on my wrist, walk out. My taxi driver was very lovely. He waited for me outside, took me to downtown Munich, where I enjoyed bratwurst for lunch and a cigar. And then I turned right back around, went back to the airport, and went, quote unquote, home to Paris for the day. So that was my little day trip to pick this watch up in Germany.
Awesome history there. And naturally, well, consider you engraved it, unless you have a fan who is willing to pay a large piece of price to acquire the watch that Rob has himself. I don't think you ever will be selling it. So that is a nice heirloom. So usually we want to advise people to acquire watches with boxes and papers. I assume you'd have the papers. Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. You certainly don't have the box, but box and papers, very typical question for anyone who is looking to acquire any watch. But very cool piece of history, very cool watch there. Elegant, understated. It serves a great purpose. And I believe at that point you were probably wearing and walking around with your initial and original Rolex, which I probably should have done a seller finance that one with a sweetheart deal, which is your 36 millimeter Day-Date champagne, yellow gold, not rose gold, because you are a rose gold guy. Probably should have bought that, but that was the watch you had there. And I believe you also had more activity as well, as when we were in Skorpios in Mykonos, great place, very fun spot if you're looking to indulge in some fun summer festivities and looking to maybe throw a couple of cocktails back. Very few places better in the world, let alone Europe, to do so than Skorpios and Mykonos. So recommend that. You also acquired another watch on Chrono 24 on that trip as well, if you want to get into that. Which you have since departed from, of course, but it's funny that of all those watches, the one you have left from your original three is this one, in fact, which is your substantially the least expensive, yet very timeless and elegant nonetheless. Goes to show that price does not equal class and value necessarily, and what is important to you. So all those things are definitely fun to think about. If you want to share the acquisition story of what you acquired while we were also in Skorpios, it could be fun to share a little inside baseball and watch acquisition talk here.
Yeah, so I think watches, I love the hobby of watch collecting, because I feel like it teaches a lot of life lessons, and it also teaches a lot of lessons that relate to investing in real estate, because they're somewhat similar asset classes, but it's all about psychology. Investing is all about psychology. And so the thing that we're learning in watches right now, for example, is the watch market has been down for a whole 2 years. And that's basically how the real estate market has been down as well. And so you're kind of learning the psychology associated with a down market. And so going through a cycle, understanding how people could go from the hype and prices going up and up to now people changing their tastes, changing their desires, and obviously prices changing a lot. So that's all an interesting learning experience. But like you said, we were enjoying our summer. We were in Greece, and a very rare Rolex came up for sale online. And so normally I wouldn't buy a watch online. That was actually the only watch I've ever purchased online, but it came up, and I could see that based on all my research online, there was really no other piece like it available for sale. And so they just didn't make a lot of these, and it was exactly what I was looking for. And so although being out and about on my phone on vacation, it didn't seem like the greatest time to do research and negotiate with the owner and try to make a purchase happen, I knew that this was my opportunity and that I couldn't let this opportunity go. And so that's exactly what I did. And it was a really fun, fantastic thing to pull off while being out on vacation. But yeah, that acquisition actually went really well. That watch now I actually gave to my mom, so she's enjoying wearing it now. And so I think that's just a good example of, if you buy quality real estate or a quality watch, for example, it can live on in your collection and have a lot of value to you, irrespective of the price you pay, if you know what you're doing.
And this just goes to show, hey, fortune favors those who are on it and are consistently checking various mediums and channels for the right opportunity. Funny enough, I didn't think it was going to happen. So I'll compare this to my life. I didn't think I was going to be selling my house, but I think I might be selling my house because I think there's a little swing trade to be done where I could sell this house and move into a neighborhood that I want to be in more long-term. Similarly, you are very perspicacious and were looking at your phone and were in the market for something that didn't necessarily need to, or that you didn't necessarily need at the time. But the timing made sense, and it was a good acquisition. And for deal junkies like you and myself, you can't ever resist a good time to buy something that you want or something that you think is for good value, especially if it's a bit more rare. So that is the nugget of the day. Keep looking, and you just never know when the opportunity is going to come up. Good deals come up every single day, just figuring out a way to maximize and utilize the value. With that said,
I was going to add, it's actually funny because I think one of the best things that people do with watches is they tie the purchase of a watch to a significant moment. So they tie it to the birth of a child, or to an anniversary or a wedding or a graduation or a closed deal, a cementing a partnership or something like that. So I think it's really, really special if you can tie the purchase of a watch to something special, because it will then tie it in your brain and it will just add a lot more meaning and also justification of spending money on a watch, right?
Where other people, it'll never make sense. Your
right,
phone does it
you're
very
crazy
well.
For spending money. Yeah. So the problem with that, while I love it, the problem with that is if you are chasing after rare birds, like we were just discussing, then you never know when the opportunity will come up, and you have to be ready, even if you're not, to take action. So for me, I wish I was in a position to do a better job of assigning a certain moment or accomplishment to a watch purchase. But the way that I'm looking to build my collection is with rare watches that, even if money is no object, you can't get your hands on it. And so I have to stay diligent and just keep at it, looking at the market, looking for the right opportunity. And if it comes up, I have to be ready to pull the trigger. And so I'd love to kind of think of a way to put both of those worlds together, where you can be an opportunistic collector yet still try to put some meaning behind it. Like maybe you buy the watch, but then you just put it away in the safe and you don't actually start wearing it. You don't introduce it into your collection until a certain thing happens, like the closing or the anniversary or whatever it is that you're looking to do.
So do you want to share also, we didn't share the watch. Do you want to share it, or do you want to keep it private as to the regards to the watch you actually acquired? Because we've led up so much of this. I'm sure people are wondering, but we will keep it a secret, it sounds like.
Yeah, we'll keep it a secret.
Very cool. And we're not going to tell, so don't email me regarding it. No, but seriously, if you don't want me to share, I won't share, but it's a very cool piece. And yeah, it just goes to show something
Got
to
to
think
keep some
about.
of the collection private.
And, you know, with that said, do you think you're going to be in the business of, you know, kind of quicker flips, or do you want to buy the beachfront property in Newport Beach, California, to know that this thing will never trade, and that, yeah, you can kind of get a how could you not price, or the price is absurd because, you know, things like this never come up and it's never going to make sense. So do you want to have more deals like that, or are you more partial to, hey, I'm going to just buy good basis and kind of flip, or are you going to have two sides to that? Are you going to have the in and out exit where it makes sense there, or are you going to just buy the best and rarest pieces?
I think just like real estate, residential and commercial, in the watch game, transactions kill returns. And so if you're constantly looking to buy and sell, flip in and out, you're going to pay in the way of transaction costs. So real estate is known to have high transaction costs. If you want to buy and sell a house, you're going to have to pay taxes. You're going to have to pay brokerage fees. You know, very well, right?
Well, not if you're an insider and you get great pricing.
Yeah, so you're in a bit of a unique
but typically
situation
speaking,
there.
Yes.
Yeah. But even in your case, I'm excited for you to potentially look to make a move to sell your house and potentially upgrade.
Still
Or
going to cost me 3.5%, which is still a discount, because it's usually, call it 6.5, you know, call it maybe or 5.5 or 6% total. But it ain't cheap to move. It comes out of your statement, and I'm gonna play the game of 2 years of ownership to avoid paying my gain. So I have to close on or probably May 5th or after. So that looks like I'll probably put my house up in the market or gear it up coming up here in the next month and a half or so. So stay tuned on that. I'll also be doing some last minute touches to my house, the before and after action, which will be fun. So
yeah. So watches are the same way. There's transaction costs. You have sales tax. You are likely, depending on how you're selling the watch. If, like, for example, if you list a watch on Chrono 24, Chrono 24 takes 6.5% right there. That's a very, so watches have an even higher transaction cost than real estate. So while I have certainly bought and sold watches in a short amount of time, I've made money on watches. I've lost money on watches. And it's all in all better to hold watches long term, especially if you have the right
Awesome.
pieces. So that's what I'd like to do. But of course, my tastes will invariably change over time. And so I'm not going to hold myself to it. At the end of the day, I'm going to only own watches that I enjoy. And if a watch needs to move out of the portfolio, I'll move it. And yeah, that's my philosophy. And it's kind of similar to real estate, where you want to be in a position to not have to sell. But if you can sell and you can create a great return for yourself, then it's great to be in a position to do that.
So much symmetry here, because it's exactly where I'm seeing it, where I just think that my area I'm currently in right now, it's not exactly where I want to live. I think there's a very good swing trade to be had to live in the neighborhood that is more ideal for my lifestyle and where I want to be long term. If I can get out of this deal for a healthy profit, yes, my interest rate will go higher, but it's not like my rate's so unbeatable. It's only a 4.85. Not saying we're going to get in the fours anytime soon, but I think low fives or mid fives, which is only what, 75 basis points away roughly from there, is probably going to be likely within the next 18 months. Then I don't necessarily need to be in this house forever, because the rate's not that attractive from the gain I'm about to get at this house, coupled with the fact that me in there moving to the area I want to live in makes more sense. Similarly to yourself, there's just, you know, an ebb and flowing. You used to be a Rolex guy, now you're more of a Patek guy. And you might be an AP guy at some point. I don't think that's going to happen, but, you know, your tastes change, your life change, life happens, you ebb and flow, keep an open mind, always look to find value like we do here at Lone Star Capital. Of course, thank you for listening to the show. We'll catch you next week.